If you know anything about advertising, there's I suppose there's two core agendas that have to be met to sell something. The first is, I gather, you need to have or create the need for the product, and then you've got to sell the product as easy and attainable and aspirational, and something that will solve the problem that you've created by establishing the need. Advertisements are generally pretty good at this. They can make you think that there are germs everywhere, and that your clothes aren't white enough, and that your teeth aren't bright enough, and that your breath is, maybe your breath is not good, who knows. The idea is to create the need and then to say, well, we've got the solution for this problem that we've called your attention to. Nicely, most of the time, the first part of the agenda with Buddhism is already taken care of. People come to centers not primarily because they've heard it's the in thing to do to meditate, or because they've seen a picture of groovy-looking meditators and want a part of it, or whatever reason. Most of the time people come because they experience the mind as they know that there's something that they'd like to work on that perhaps a spiritual practice might help out with. So we're aware that there's an issue that might need to be addressed, or we get the beginning of the notion of it. Unfortunately, a lot of writers and teachers and people try to overly sell Buddhism and make it sound really easy, make meditation sound like it's a piece of cake, which can lead to a lot of disappointment. It's not easy. And a lot of times the Dhamma is, people try to cut away the difficult parts and sell it like it's this really easy thing to just put into your life, that it won't be too disruptive. In most cases, I've experienced that when we really have a good practice and we're really beginning to be mindful, it makes us begin to question everything, the way we use our mind throughout the day, our lifestyle, even our work and the way we relate to people. So it's not like a easy, smooth fit all the time into life, but it's an incredibly worthwhile one. It's understandable that people like to sell things this way, because we gravitate towards things that are easy. The Buddha said in the numbered discourses, the Anguttara Nikaya, he said that there are four reasons we create trouble for ourselves and stress and suffering. They're sort of in pairs. The first two are that we tend to gravitate towards things that are really easy and feel good immediately. And we tend to avoid behaviors and practices that are challenging and require effort and don't have immediate payoffs. The second two are that we tend to fixate on our self-centered thinking and our fear-driven stories. I'll talk about that in a second, but the first set, the Buddha said that you could tell the wise person from a fool simply by noticing that a wise person realizes that a lot of the things that are good for us in the long term aren't particularly easy or feel good immediately. It's not just flossing our teeth and eating vegetables. It's also It can be from anything from learning to play a musical instrument or to develop an athletic skill in something, or to even things like generosity, developing a practice of gratitude, a practice of metta, friendliness towards ourselves and others. All of this stuff goes against the grain. It's not very promoted. Well, maybe exercises, but and playing musical instruments is. But a lot of the stuff that really feels good in the long term go against the grain of culture and the way the mind is hardwired. For example, we live in a culture that promises we just buy the one more thing, or accumulate more friends, or win more praise, or have a really established career, that will make us safe and secure and happy. And then people, of course, reach a point in life where no matter how much status and reputation and money they've accumulated, they still feel empty. And eventually the status seeking just becomes more and more hollow. And often by that point it's too late to address the issue, or very difficult to. So it takes a lot of it takes a really remarkable experience to push us into spiritual practice. The second, because we're, again, so gravitating towards things that are quick and easy. People love the magic bullet, to take the pill, the idea that if I just do one easy thing, maybe that will make me get a purpose or a sense of inner happiness or a sense of inner self-esteem. So we're looking for, on a whole cultural-wide level, our society is based on the idea that you just need to find that one thing, accumulate it, and that will be the thing that rescues us. So the second set of that gets us into trouble is the listening to our self-centered stories, the stories about who I am and what I am and, how many difficulties I've overcome and where I'm going in the future and what do people think about me and all this stuff about me. We tend to filter our experiences through this whole, how does this fit in my story about myself? And the last area is fear, worry, concern, trying to figure out all the bad shit that can happen to us. And a lot of the ways the mind accomplishes these, this self-centeredness and the fear is by creating little inner movies in our mind. We all have wonderful multiplexes where we can, in our minds, where we can jump around from one theater to the other. Some of the movies are called I Suck, and the other movie is called I'm the Greatest, and I Know More Than You, and another movie is called Why Do I Have to Do This? My Life is Hard Enough Already. And the movies we play in our mind are more fantastic than the most astonishing film you could ever see. We can create all sorts of unlikely outcomes and imagine it in full-blown detail with the, we can picture all the horrible things that can go wrong. And because we're so dependent upon our thoughts and our minds to navigate through life, to get us through our days, we depend on our minds to tell us when we can cross the street safely and when we can't. We depend on our minds to know when it's time to eat and when it's time to sleep and all this stuff that we begin to believe everything that occurs in the mind. Every thought that arises we believe is worth listening to. Every fear, no matter how unlikely, every fantasy. There's a word for, there's a psychological term for the fact that men tend to over-believe that women are interested in them just by the slightest bit. It's very humorous. If you go to a restaurant with a guy and a waitress will smile and say, "Can I help you?" And the guy, when she goes away, will go, "And inevitably, she likes me." It's too bad I'm in a relationship. So the mind can, out of breadcrumbs, create entire cakes with layering. And we love these stories, these movies, because for a number of reasons, they promise us control over where things we have no control over. We believe if, for instance, we can predict all the shitty outcomes that will happen in life, exactly how they'll play out, that we'll somehow be prepared and have a escape plan. We also like to think that we could figure out what other people are thinking about us, or what's going to happen to me in the future, or any of those stuff. And of course, none of those things we have any real, we'll ever really know. There's too many variables well beyond our control. But because they promise us so much, and because the mind is so used to trusting itself, trusting its thoughts, it's very difficult to put aside these fears and these self-centered delusions. Often the biggest problem about them is that when we get ourselves into trouble by pursuing a relationship or a job or a friendship or something that's not good for us, it could be an addiction, that we don't see that we've caused ourselves suffering, because we then immediately go into a delusion about how, well, I can make this work. I can figure it out. I can get out of this. Or it's not my fault. It's their fault. I just have to figure out why it's their fault. So, as one of my teachers, Ajahn Jeff, says, there's part of the mind that likes to be fooled, the part that chases after things that feel good and runs away from difficult situations and uncomfortable things that help us grow. And then there's the part of the mind that likes to fool itself, the part that comes up with all the stories and fantasies and fears and self-centered delusions. So to get out of this, it's not enough to know that we need, that there's a way out. We very often need, as I say in 12-step programs, to really experience the fact that there's stress in our lives, that there's suffering, that we've come to a place where something that we've taken for granted or believed is necessary has gotten us in a lot of trouble. Sometimes it can be, hopefully, it won't take too much, but sometimes people come because of a relationship that falls apart, or because they've bottomed out on taking a drug or a job they've suddenly seen to be not fulfilling, or a relationship with their families suddenly becomes untenable because they're trying to control or trying to get acknowledgement from people who won't give them acknowledgement. And so we suddenly come face to face with the futility of so many of our cravings and the results of our trying to get happiness out of places and people that are not going to give it to us. And then hopefully that experience will be enough to push us to the willingness to try something that's very difficult. Mindfulness is not just sitting for 15, 20 minutes a day and bringing the awareness within and training the mind to be kind and aware. It's more than that. It's throughout the course of the day opening to, is there stress? Is there tightness? Is my mind agitated? Am I filled with worry? Am I in a place that feels comfortable? Or when I let go of whatever I'm focusing on and bring my awareness within, is it comfortable inside of me, or is it really uncomfortable? This is a lot of work. But the good news is that we can get to a place where we can really develop a really insightful tool that can help us navigate between knowing which relationships, which jobs, which people, which behaviors, which habits are really good for us, and which are the ones that we're just futilely chasing. I was talking with a friend who's a really well-known psychiatrist, and he said that when people come to him from other doctors, the one thing they want to do is immediately stop taking everything that they're taking and just go on an entirely new regimen of medications. And he said the problem with that, even though it's tempting as a doctor to want to give into it, is that if you suddenly change everything that somebody's taking, they won't know what was working and what wasn't working. You have to change, he says, one thing at a time. It's the same thing with life. Very often we're filled up with so much going on in our lives. And when we hit a bottom, or when we reach a place where we're just really stressed out, there's a temptation to want to say, fuck it, I'm going to quit my job, I'm going to move to Bali, and I'm going to live in a yoga center where I'm going to teach yoga, and that will be the solution. And of course, what's going on there is quitting the job, moving, throwing away friendships, and finding entirely another place to life. That's changing everything. There's no way to know then what is causing stress and what is not. So rather than gravitate to the easy, fun thing to do, which is when we hit a bottom, just throw it all away, and then, you know, just... It's funny, when you go to 12-step meetings, the one story you hear all over and over again is that the thing that kept people from realizing the obvious that their drinking or their drugging was causing them suffering is that for years when they would hit bottom, they'd move to an entirely another city, find a whole new group of friends. And of course, by changing everything in life, it completely doesn't allow us to see that if we simply remove one part of the equation, in that case, it's drinking, then suddenly things start to clear up. So part of the experience of having a bottom where we realize that something's not working in our lives is, for example, if you do want to add a meditation practice, do that for a while. Let that be the thing, and for a couple weeks, just say, I'm going to meditate and just notice if there's stress in the body. Or if you want to put this off for a while and you want to say, well, first I'm going to just leave this job and get another job, or I'm going to leave this friendship or this relationship, or I'm going to do something other, that's fine. But the two tricks are, don't change everything altogether, because you'll never know what then was causing the stress. And B, you want to stay with that for a little while. The mind wants to get immediate results. We want to, you know, we're like people who go to the gym, work out for a half an hour, and then stand in front of the mirror, looking pretty good. Yeah. And you look at them and you're like, you look no different than when you came. You've only done this once. You know, they're like, ming, ming. So that's part of, you know, part of a spiritual practice, or investigating suffering means make a change and stay with it for a while and see. Part of the beauty of developing meditation is that during meditation, it's not just only about cultivating peace. It can also be about investigating thoughts that we think are really helpful, and then beginning to see, wow, this entire line of thought that pops up in my mind is in fact causing stress. It's making my mind more and more agitated, or it's making my body tighter, or it's making my, you know, breath feel really shallow, or it's making it difficult for me to settle down and relax. And very often in meditation, I'll like go to something that's been an obsessive thought, and I'll invite it to come up. It sounds unlikely that people would in meditation, but monks I've studied with have even said that this is a really legitimate part of practice, is to see, okay, here's worry about money. What does this do to me? Does this really make me immediately have a solution? Or does it just play over and over and over in my head, spilling out bad scenarios, causing tightness in my stomach and my shoulders to go up? Does it make it so that I can't put down that story? It's really wonderful to have an ability to get some distance from these thoughts, enough just to notice, well, what really happens when I start thinking about my family, or what really starts happening when I try to figure out this thing or control that? Am I really getting anywhere, or what is occurring outside of it, in the body, in the mind? How does it affect my mood? Eventually, we can get a lot of insight by really letting go of the idea that anything is inevitable for us. We all come in to our practice with this idea that, I'm an angry person. I once had a guy that called me up and used to say, I'm a really angry guy. I'm really angry. I'm just a really angry person. I'll never get beyond my anger. And I'd say, well, are you angry right now? And he'd say, well, no, I'm talking to you. I'm not particularly angry. And then I'd say, well, then you're not an angry person. You're just somebody who's capable of anger. But if that's who you were, you would be it all the time. All you're saying, when all we come in to practice with is a lot of tendencies. But none of us come in with anything written in stone. We're not fearful, angry, smart, dumb, you know, driven or not driven. We all just have tendencies. And the beauty is that when we are willing to investigate, really open up to see, then we can really begin to get a distance from things that we felt, chained to. All these stories, these self-centered stories that the Buddha said lead us astray, all they are prisons. Every time I tell a story about myself, even the positive ones, I was talking to a friend who's a well-known musician, and he said, for years, calling myself a musician and a songwriter was a way I could give myself an identity and make myself popular with people and, you know, deal with women and give myself courage to feel like I deserved to be alive. But then I realized that this calling myself a songwriter, in fact, this was something that was completely excluding me from a lot of things that I really needed to develop. I never learned how to be self-sufficient, how to deal with the business side of my life. I never learned how to pay my taxes or how to engage in difficult, you know, points of a relationship, because as a musician, I would just move on. So a lot of these stories we tell about ourselves, even though they at first sound really exciting, when we investigate them and really open up to what are they bringing to our lives, we see that, in fact, wow, who I really thought I was is, in fact, something that's really pinning me down and limiting me. None of this is particularly easy. But the good news is that there's liberation at the end of this endeavor. By being willing to investigate on a moment-by-moment basis the way we feel, the way we think, the way we relate to other people, the things we do, our lifestyle, everything, one by one, with an objective, calm, mind that's willing to just see, eventually we can get to a place where we're capable of so much more peace and tranquility than we ever imagined. So that's all I got tonight. Threw that talk together pretty quickly, but I hope there was something there for you. And now it's your chance to ask any questions. So I thank you for listening.